Studio 360.
Last month, HBO premiered a new adaptation of Ray Bradbury's classic novel Fahrenheit 451, starring Michael B. Jordan and Hollywood's current go-to evil G-man, Michael Shannon. The story takes place in a world where firemen go house to house to start fires, to burn books.
Benjamin Franklin, the founder of our first fire department, gave us the right to burn.
Those are lies. Ben Franklin did not do that.
After the last of your generation dies, so will your words, your memories, and the burden of your fake past.
Since the 2016 election, as fretting about free speech and authoritarianism reached a new pitch, Fahrenheit 451 has had a general revival, along with other mid-century dystopian regime novels like 1984 and Animal Farm and Man in the High Castle. As part of our continuing series on American icons, Eric Molinsky looks at how a story written 65 years ago feels freshly relevant.
Can I have your levels again?
This is me. This is me talking. This is me still talking. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
That is the voice of Neil Gaiman, master of modern fantasy. But he wasn't here to talk about the stories that he's best known for, like American Gods, Sandman, or Coraline. He wanted to talk about a book that made a huge impact on him as a child, Fahrenheit 451. And as a kid, he was particularly fascinated with the main character.
He was a fireman. He burned down houses of people with books. And that seemed a cool science fictional idea in itself, because I lived in a world in which firemen came and saved you and they put out fires. And I didn't really understand things like his marriage falling apart. Huge swatches of the plot I missed. But that's fine, because when you're 9 years old, you know that you're going to read the book later. And you'll take from it what is there for you.
The writer Alice Hoffman, who's best known for the novel Practical Magic, also discovered Fahrenheit 451 as a child. Now, at the time, her parents had just divorced. And one of the few things that her father left behind was a collection of books full of Ray Bradbury novels.
You know, it was a time, really, when I needed a sort of a father figure or moral voice. And I feel like Ray is that. He was such a moral voice. There was such a center. There was a sense of right and wrong in his books. You know, that's a good thing, especially when you're a young reader.
But as a young reader, she eventually put the book away, and she didn't pick it up again until September of 2001.
You know, I didn't believe in writer's block until I had it. I had it after 9/11 because I felt like there was no point in doing anything, but certainly no point in writing. I felt like books were going to burn up, and there was just no point in going on. So I had this horrible writer's block, and my inner child or my inner self told me to go back and read Fahrenheit 451. And when I read that book again, I realized how important books were, and I realized how important stories were, and I was able to write again.
In Fahrenheit 451, each of the characters represents a challenge to the reader. If you lived in this dystopian world, what would you do? Who would you be? Rich Orlow has thought about that a lot.
I do have the ability, pat yourself on the back, but to sort of morph myself into other characters.
For the last decade, he's been performing a one-man show of Fahrenheit 451 using a script that was approved by Ray Bradbury before Bradbury died in 2012. Now, Rich does all the voices in the show, but the character he says he identifies with the most is Guy Montag, the main character, the fireman, who starts to question why he's burning books.
You know, he goes from someone who is kind of destructive, he thinks he knows it all, he's kind of angry, but there's a core in him that tells him that there's something more than this. And that's kind of how I was when I was young. I was kind of a not the happiest kid. That's for sure. I was very angry. I grew up in not the best circumstances per se. And, you know, I had a lot of wrong ways of seeing the world, thinking I knew it all too. And then, you know, getting away from home and going to college and meeting people that were different that I thought I had all these judgments on, I was totally wrong. And he doesn't know anything. Eventually, at the end of the book, he says, I was an idiot the whole way. I can identify with that, you know.
So here's Rich performing a scene where Montag reveals for the first time to his wife, Millie, that he's unhappy with his work.
When I wake up, I have chills and a fever.
Oh, you can't be sick. You were all right last night.
Millie, do you know what happened last night? We burned 1,000 books. We burnt a woman.
Well?
Well? Well, you should have seen her, Millie. God, there's got to be things in books. Things that you can't imagine to make a woman stay in a burning house. You wouldn't stay for nothing. She was as rational as you and I, and we burnt her. Have you ever seen a burning house? It smolders for days. I've been trying to put it out in my mind. I'm crazy with trying. And I'm sick. And it's not just the woman that died. I'm thinking about all the kerosene that I have used in the past 10 years. And I am thinking about those books. And for the first time, I realized that there was a man behind each one of those books. A man had to think them up. A man had to put them down on paper. It may have taken some man a lifetime to put his thoughts down on paper, and then along I come in 2 minutes and boom, it's all over.
Oh, leave me alone. I didn't do anything to you.
Wow, that was chilling.
Thank you.
So, wow, it's so interesting to hear Millie.
When I think of Millie, I mean, she self-medicates. I mean, the whole book, she's half out of it. Her character never really confronts the really underlying cause of all these things. She distracts herself with television, and that's her life. She even calls them her TV family.
Now, the opposite of Millie, who just kind of goes along with the program, is Montag's next-door neighbor, Clarice McClellan. She only appears in the beginning of the book, but she plays a pivotal role. She awakens Montag's conscience.
You know, I'm not afraid of you at all. So many people are. They're afraid of firemen, but you are just a man after all. How long have you worked at being a fireman?
Since I was 20. 10 years ago.
Do you ever read any of the books that you burn?
No. That's against the law.
Oh, yes, of course.
Hey, it's fine work. Monday, you burn Edna Millay. Wednesday, Walt Whitman. Friday, Faulkner. You burn them to ashes, and then you burn the ashes. That's our official slogan.
Is it true that a long time ago, firemen used to put out fires instead of going to start them?
No.
That's strange, because I heard that houses used to burn by accident, and they needed firemen to stop the flames.
Now, the fourth major character in the book is Montag's boss, the anti-intellectual Captain Beatty.
We must all be alike. Not everybody born free and equal like the Constitution says, but everybody made equal. Each man the image of every other. For then, all are happy. For there are no mountains to judge yourself against or to make you cower. So, a book is a loaded weapon in the house next door. Burn it. Burn it! Who knows who may be the target of a well-read man?
Now, that is actually a very important moment, because Beatty reveals something to Montag which may be surprising to some readers. It was actually surprising to me the first time I read the book. This whole book-burning business did not come from the government, at least not at first. It came from the people. Every book contained something that somebody found offensive. So firemen began burning the most offensive books, the people cheered, and they kept going.
When the houses were finally fireproofed completely, there was no longer a need of firemen for the old purposes. They were given a new job, as the custodians of our peace of mind, the focus of our rightful dread of being inferior, official censors, judges, and executioners. That is you, Montag. And that's me.
Now, we don't live in a society that burns books, but I was curious, how prevalent is it for books to be banned? So I talked with James LaRue, the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association. He says local libraries are supposed to report to the American Library Association every time someone asks for a book to be removed from the shelves. Officially, they get about 360 challenges a year. But James LaRue says he knows that the vast majority of libraries do not report the challenges. So he estimates they could actually be in the thousands. But if a challenge does make it all the way up to him,
we would hand you the form that says, did you read the whole thing? What specifically concerns you about it? Can you recommend other books from a different perspective that you think we should have to balance this? And then that request for reconsideration goes to typically a committee. We put together a group of people to say, read the whole thing, look at the selection policy and say, should we keep this book? Does it fit? Is it a good match? And when that sort of thoughtful conversation takes place, typically the committee will say, no, the book's okay. Very few books are in fact dangerous. As I often say, you can look at the world today and say there are many problems, but reading too much is not one of them.
So which books get challenged the most? He says for the most part, that depends on the year.
So for instance, if I go back to 2015, 9 of the top 10 most frequently challenged books were about diverse populations, by or about diverse populations. So LGBT, particular focus on transgendered. Or it might be people who fell into the minority group of Muslim. So anything that gave a positive portrayal of Muslims, you know, got lots of pushback.
Jonathan Eller is the director of the Center for Ray Bradbury Studies at Indiana University. And he says book banning was very much on Bradbury's mind when he wrote Fahrenheit 451 in the early 1950s, on the eve of the McCarthy hearings.
Ray Bradbury felt that the ban on books or the censorship of books would probably start with supernatural literature and fantasy. And so he started to write a series of about a half a dozen stories in the late 40s that touched on the issue of the banning of supernatural fiction or the burning of supernatural fiction.
Did I read that he was descended from Mary Bradbury, who's one of the people in the Salem Witch Trials?
Oh, yes. He was. Mary Bradbury was his direct ancestor. She was tried, of course, in the early 1690s, found guilty of taking on spectral forms. I think it was the form of a wild boar, someone accused her of. She was found guilty and sentenced to die. But over time, the colonial government changed and she was spared.
But Ray Bradbury's initial spark of inspiration for Fahrenheit 451 came from a personal experience. One night, he was walking with a friend in Los Angeles, and a policeman stopped and questioned them, because apparently it was strange to just be walking at night in Los Angeles. Bradbury was so annoyed, he wrote a short story called The Pedestrian, which took place in a totalitarian future where people were so distracted by technology they didn't even bother going out of their houses and take a walk. And that short story eventually evolved into the world of Fahrenheit 451, where technology is so all-consuming and distracting, people don't even read books anymore. And one of the most endearing details about Fahrenheit 451 is that Bradbury wrote the novel on a coin-operated typewriter at his local library. He later would jokingly refer to it as his dime novel. When it was done, he called the fire department to ask what temperature a book would burn. They told him 451 degrees, and that's how he got the title. When it was finally published in 1953, Fahrenheit 451 was considered a success, critically and commercially. But it was not seen as an instant classic. For a long time, other Ray Bradbury books, like The Martian Chronicles, were much more popular.
But by the 80s and 90s, as we're dealing with these technological marvels, and we have the challenge of preserving unmediated literature and great ideas, people began to see that to remind us all that literacy is important. Then Fahrenheit began to become a staple in school.
Now, remember when James LaRue of the American Library Association said that different books get challenged every year depending on what's controversial? Well, there are some books that people try to ban every year, decade after decade. And Fahrenheit 451 is one of those books.
You know, the challenges go everything from language. So someone will say, there is profanity in this book. Well, there's profanity in many books, and so often it winds up being a cover for what the real issue is. So in this case, the idea is that for Fahrenheit 451, that censorship is somehow not a good thing when how dare someone challenge the authority of the government or, by extension, the parent to say, we don't want our children to read this.
And if you think that is ironic, people trying to ban a book about burning books, it gets worse. For a while, there was an edited version of Fahrenheit 451 circulated in schools. Words that may be deemed offensive, like hell and damn, had been removed. When Bradbury found out about this, he was mad. He got the original text reinstated and wrote a new coda that is still in every copy of Fahrenheit 451. Again, Jonathan Eller.
It's a coda in which he says, at the end, I will not go gently onto a shelf, degutted, to become a non-book.
And here is Ray Bradbury himself.
I get letters from teachers all the time saying my books have been banned temporarily. I said, don't worry about it. Put them back on the shelves. And they come in and find them on the shelves again. And you say, gee, how'd they get back on there? You know, and you keep putting them back and they keep taking them off. And you finally win, you know. Mm-hmm. But be very quiet about it and don't ask for my help. Because if I come to your town to help you, I'm a big frog in a small puddle. And they're going to hate me. All of them. Mm-hmm. All the people. So you can't ask me to interfere. You do the job. Mm-hmm. You're the librarian. You're the teacher. Stand firm and you'll win. And they always do.
Now, part of what helped Fahrenheit 451 endure was the way that it got adapted. It's been turned into a graphic novel, movies, a play.
Now don't make me use this.
There have been radio drama adaptations on both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, that's one way to get an audience at the end of a flamethrower.
Phil Nichols teaches TV and film at the University of Wolverhampton in the UK. His specialty are media adaptations of Ray Bradbury's work.
They've all been so different and so playful.
And strangely enough, the first film adaptation of Fahrenheit 451 did not come from Hollywood. The 1966 film was directed by François Truffaut.
It's a very strange film. It's a combination of French New Wave filmmaking and an American story. And it was shot in England, and it was directed by a director who didn't speak a word of English, even though the film was made in English.
And the actor playing Montag had a thick Austrian accent.
We burn them to ashes and then burn the ashes. That's our official motto.
You don't like books, then?
Books are just so much rubbish. They have no interest.
The writer Neil Gaiman was never a big fan of that movie, and he was particularly disturbed by the ending. Now, to some extent, the ending of the movie is similar to the book. Montag quits the fire department, and he joins the Resistance, where he discovers the, quote, book people, who invented a really ingenious way to preserve books. Each of them chooses a book to memorize.
I think in the book, you can almost hear the trumpets as people are introduced, as you realize that, yes, you can destroy a book, but you cannot destroy the content of the book. And as long as some books are people, the books are inside us and we can bring them out again. You know, the return to the oral tradition is wonderful. In the film, nobody is telling the content of their book to another person. And I think that is the thing that makes it seem like madness, like a waste of time, like pointless. They're all on their own, not making eye contact with each other, mumbling their stories, mumbling their books that they've remembered.
I'm going to relate a tale full of horror.
Ray Bradbury always had mixed feelings about the Truffaut film, but he wrote a play in the 1970s that incorporated a lot of ideas that Truffaut had invented for the film into Bradbury's new theatrical version of Fahrenheit 451. But the biggest change that Bradbury made was something brand new that did not come from the Truffaut film. He took the character of Captain Beatty, who had been sort of a two-dimensional villain in the book, and made him more of an anti-hero. Jonathan Eller says this actually came from Bradbury's own insecurities as a writer.
He always worried the most about writing character. He knew that he had very interesting ideas based on the basic fears and hopes and aspirations and terrors and loves of human beings. But sometimes he had to work very hard to develop characters.
And all the work that Ray Bradbury did on the character of Captain Beatty struck a chord with Julia Wilhelm. In the spring of 2018, she was a senior at McKinney Boyd High School outside Dallas. And when she learned that her drama teacher was going to put on the play of Fahrenheit 451.
I read the script, and the character that I really wanted to play was Beatty. And because it was the most complex and contradictory character in the show, kind of like a Aaron Burr, like a Judas, you know.
Now, Jonathan Pitzer is Julia's drama teacher. And in this case, he decided not to do traditional auditions. He interviewed the kids to find out how deeply they had thought about Fahrenheit 451. And he was pretty blown away when he talked with Julia.
She came with notes, and she had like a PowerPoint, and she had drawings of the characters, and she had really put in the time for Captain Beatty. And I told her, I said, you know that's a man, right? And she said, yeah, but it doesn't have to be. That's the part I want.
Maybe you have to have some
reciting,
sort of...
You're reciting. Yeah.
The ashes that burn the ashes.
Yeah, and yes, I would say it like it's something that you've heard said every single day when you're at the firehouse or something. Yeah. Kind of like if you're in my class, you hear every day is an audition all the time and stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's something that you hear Beatty say all the time.
Now, when Jonathan Pitzer decided to put on Fahrenheit 451 at McKinney Boyd High School, he thought the kids would relate to the show because a lot of it is about technology. I mean, Bradbury was really prescient. The characters walk around with devices in their ears called seashells, which look remarkably like Bluetooth earbuds. Everybody has wall-size, flat-screen TVs, even interactive television. And the HBO movie adaptation from 2018 featured all that stuff pretty heavily.
Here tonight.
Welcome, natives. And everybody at home watching on the nine. Look what we found hiding in your beautiful neighborhood.
Michael B. Jordan played Montag as a social media star who burns books on live simulcasts with emojis of fire and smiley faces floating up around him.
Damn, it's a pleasure to burn.
Everybody watching at home with a nine, are you ready?
And the teenage kids at McKinney Boyd High School did relate to the technology aspect of the play. But something else spoke to them, something that they deal with on a more regular basis. It's the question of how do you fight dangerous ideas in a country that guarantees freedom of speech? In Fahrenheit 451, those are two different issues. The books, on paper, contain all the ideas. The technology is full of empty distractions. But in the real world, these days, technology is the battleground for offensive ideas.
Once, Montag, we were a small country, but then we grew.
This is Julie Wilhelm, performing as Captain Beatty.
And by the millions, they poured in upon us, and finally you have 300 million doctors, lawyers, Baptists, block-headed Swedes, beer-fat Germans. Blacks don't like Little Black Sambo? Burn it. White people hate Uncle Tom's Cabin? Burn it. The Jews hate Fagin and Oliver Twist? Burn Fagin. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice? Women's Lib hates that. Into the furnace. More comic books, more gossip, plenty of facts, but no meaning. And there you have it, Montag. Lecture's over.
Fahrenheit 451 has grown beyond being just a book. It's an idea. It's a living document that's taken on a life of its own. Ideas are resilient, especially good ideas. They can be more powerful than any author, book, movie, or play. Again, the novelist Alice Hoffman.
You know, I think it's iconic because every generation has the fears that are in Fahrenheit 451. How do we continue to be people who care about books and care about life and care about the truth? And I also think right now there's this sense of the news can be manipulated, which it is manipulated in Fahrenheit 451, and that books can be viewed as dangerous, the truth can be viewed as dangerous. And there's kind of a mob mentality, and I feel like this book should be on every reading list.
That story was produced by Eric Malinsky, whose podcast about fantasy and science fiction is called Imaginary Worlds. Our American Icon series is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.